From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, Senior Reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. A lone gunman shot and killed a Canadian Army reservist and terrorized the Canadian Parliament in the second attack with a possible link to Islamic extremism in that normally peaceful country. Turkey agreed to allow several hundred Iraqi Kurds to reinforce the embattled Syrian border town of Kobani, but U.S. officials said that Turkey and some U.S. Arab allies could do more to reduce the funds amassed by the group that calls itself the Islamic State. North Korea released an American detainee in a possible effort to restart talks with the United States 20 years after a landmark nuclear agreement. That agreement fell apart under the George W. Bush administration, and North Korea has since conducted 3 nuclear tests. And finally, in Hong Kong, where pro-democracy protests have been going on for weeks, 5 student leaders debated the city's number 2 official and urged her to commit to allowing more freedom in future elections. Well, gentlemen, we're going to start unusually with Canada, which is normally a very peaceful, even placid, even boring country, shall I say. But this incident spread panic throughout Ottawa. Tim, what do we know about the gunman and the reasons for this terrible attack?
I mean, there's good reason at this point to suspect that he was motivated, at least in part, by radical Islamic ideology. However, we also see an individual that appears to be mentally ill, is disturbed, said the devil was after him, has a criminal record involving robbery and assault. This is not a very clear-cut case at all. I mean, while he says he's motivated by ideology, there's also indications that he is not a well individual. And what is so interesting about this is that it was the second attack on Canadian military service members in just 3 days.
Right.
A very rare occurrence in Canada, even though they have been at war over the last 13 years, much like the United States has been in Afghanistan. And recently, Canada's parliament decided to approve airstrikes against ISIS, to join that coalition to roll back ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So there's a lot of conversation in Ottawa, all across Canada right now, as to how to prevent such attacks in the future. I mean, whether giving up civil liberties in order to prevent these very unpredictable attacks is really worth it.
Yeah, Stephen, apparently the area where this took the attack took place, Parliament Hill, is normally not only peaceful, but it's completely open to the public there, that you don't see the kinds of barricades that you do, of course, in Washington or London or other major cities. Will the Canadians have to start to rethink this? And is there anything more you can tell us about this?
Yeah, it looks like they're going to have to take a real look at security measures. You're right, and Ottawa is actually a very small, sort of cozy city. It's one of those federal capitals, somewhat like Bern in Switzerland, or Bonn or Canberra, and it's not the big, massive capital city you see everywhere. There's not the kind of security posture around politicians and institutions that you see elsewhere, so that's probably going to change. It's kind of interesting because this is exactly the kind of attack that U.S. national security officials have been worrying about. They say the biggest threat of terrorism on U.S. soil is probably not from ISIS operatives coming into the country, although they're very worried about that, people with Western passports coming out of Syria, but this idea that someone who's perhaps a little disturbed, who's isolated from his own community, who's sort of on the outs, can be inspired by the sort of stuff you see on the internet, the rhetoric of Islamic rhetoric, the kind of idea of finally belonging to something.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that U.S. officials are very worried it could happen in the United States. It's already happened in London last year. A soldier was attacked on the streets of London by some radicalized British Muslims. So it's as we saw in Ottawa, it's very difficult to defend against.
Yeah, apparently the gunman, Michael Zihaf Bibo, his father is apparently from Libya. But also, Tim, you're absolutely right. He had a number of criminal convictions. He was living in a homeless shelter in Ottawa when this attack occurred. So whether it's mental illness, criminal tendencies, or some sort of radicalization that came from the internet, I suppose, is not something we'll know. He was, of course, killed himself once he got inside the parliament in Ottawa. Canada obviously has to rethink, and the United States also has to be on the lookout for individuals like this.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I used to work in Parliament Hill, so I've lived in Ottawa, and I know how much people value that openness. There's an entire campus there in front of on Parliament Hill that's wide open, green space, and it's really a gorgeous area, and millions of people visit it every year. And security is such that you can walk right into Parliament, and there are two guards there, but they're unarmed.
Do they have a metal detector? Or
They do have metal detectors, but really the first line of defense is two guards that are standing there without sidearm.
Wow.
You have to go up the stairs, and then there are a couple plainclothes officers who, during this attack, weren't able to fire at the gunman because there were children in that foyer. So they weren't able to immediately react to the gunman, and the gunman went on a bit of a spree before he was shot down, amazingly, by the sergeant of arms of Parliament, which is a largely ceremonial role, who happened to be in his office, happened to have a sidearm there, and reacted very swiftly, and is really a heroic figure now, and will be remembered for quite some time in Canadian history. So yeah, I mean, definitely security was a real thing. And Canada has more than a few people that they're concerned are already radicalized and could carry out such attacks in the future. We've seen just two this week, but the Canadian Intelligence Services estimates something like 90 people on their watch list that either want to travel abroad to fight on behalf of these radical organizations or to conduct attacks in Canada itself.
And should this individual have been on one of those lists? Was he on one of those lists?
He was not on the list. He was in the process of trying to get a passport to go to Turkey, but he was not yet on the list. I think the intelligence services are right now saying that had the process continued, he would have been a likely candidate for that list of 90.
So he wasn't able to go to Syria or to via Turkey. So I suppose this was the route he chose. One other last thing on Canada, Stephen. They have a conservative prime minister and so on. So I would assume that their policies on Iraq and so on are not going to change because of this.
I don't think they'll change, but it'll be interesting to watch how the political fallout of this develops. The prime minister Stephen Harper is facing an election next year. After a period of minority governments, he consolidated into a majority government, but he's facing a tough re-election fight next year. So it'll be interesting to see how the political dynamics on this shift. Another issue, you know, Canada's renowned for its very sort of open and liberal immigration system. If you go to somewhere like Toronto or Vancouver, I mean, it's basically a melting pot for the world. It's a very international country. It will be interesting to see if that sort of welcoming attitude to immigrants and people of, you know, a multitude of faiths changes at all. I personally, I don't think it's very likely to, just on the basis of a couple of incidents. But everywhere that Islamic radicalism in any form takes place, there are political ramifications, especially in Western countries. We saw it in the US, we saw it in Britain, in Belgium, France, and places. So it's going to be interesting to see how the kind of political fallout from this develops.
Yeah, indeed. Talking about the group that calls itself the Islamic State, I went to an event recently with the Under Secretary of the Treasury, David Cohen, who deals with efforts to try to stop revenue flows to terrorist organizations like ISIS or IS. And he said that there are something like 15, 16,000 foreign fighters at least that have flocked to this group. Also said that they're earning between $1 and $2 million a day from selling and oil products. And among the clients for these oil products is the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad, which is supposed to be an opponent of the Islamic State. Also, Turks act as middlemen, Iraqi Kurds, opposed to the Islamic State, act as middlemen for this oil. And they make a fortune out of ransom, something like $20 million a year out of ransom. They also loot antiquities. They steal agricultural products. They sell women into sexual slavery. I mean, this is one well-financed group. How are we supposed to cut off their finances?
I'm not sure there's an easy answer to that. Stop paying for ransoms, perhaps. But, I mean, if Syria is purchasing oil, I don't think there's a very good answer for that from a financing perspective. Wherever they're suffering, there will be some terrible group there trying to make money off of it. And that's what we're seeing here. The Islamic State is not particularly woven into the international community or the economic system. It's very hard to create barriers to them.
Well, but that was something that David Cohen was talking about. There are places, because the Islamic State controls so much territory, it actually is trying to use banks, for example, in Iraq, in the area that it controls. And so here, the U.S. Treasury Department is working with the Iraqi authorities, but it's very hard because they don't want to shut down the banks because that would unfairly penalize ordinary people in those areas. But they want to prevent those banks from being used as a way for the Islamic State to launder revenues and to send money, to transfer money abroad. Similarly, this business with the oil sales to the Syrian government, this is kind of an unintended consequence of U.S. sanctions on Syria. Assad has to get his oil from somewhere, right? And the only alternative apparently now is this group which we're all supposedly fighting. So it's complex, but I think you also went to a briefing that Cohen gave. Can we thread this needle, do you think?
I don't know. You know, as with everything in the Syria conflict and the Middle East, this just shows the massive contradictions and difficulties of conflicting loyalties and everything else that you sort of come up against when you plunge into this sort of war. The interesting thing about the briefing by Cohen was that it sort of revealed two things which we hear repeatedly about this Syria operation. Number one, it's going to take time.
Right.
And number two, everything that happens exposes a new level of complexity and difficulty which challenges the U.S. strategy. For example, the attack on Kobani, U.S. airstrikes been pummeling Islamic State fighters. The problem has been is that, first of all, the Kurdish forces there, who are nominally on the U.S. side, have been very disorganized. They've been undermanned. We had U.S. Planes airdrop ammunition and guns into them so they can take on the Islamic State. You've got the whole issue of Turkey, which, despite intense U.S. pressure and being a NATO ally, refused to let Kurdish reinforcements go through Turkish territory.
Supposedly now they're going to let a couple hundred.
Now they're saying 200 Peshmergas allowed through.
But from Iraqi Kurdistan.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So you have the whole, you know, Turkey is a NATO ally of the United States, but in this situation when it has its own sort of priorities on the table and its own problems with the whole Kurdish issue, it's not necessarily a reliable ally. So let's not forget, 2 months ago, the president gave a speech and said, we will do airstrikes in Iraq if necessary. Now we've gone onto a pretty large scale air attack to bolster the Kurds on the Turkish Syria border. So it seems like the operation is expanding. And although we've seen reports this week that maybe 500 Islamic State fighters have been killed in recent days in U.S. airstrikes, the fundamentals of the conflict on the ground, both in Iraq and Syria, don't seem to be improving that much from the U.S. point of view. And part of the reason is because the allies that are going to do the fighting on the ground are still ill-equipped, disorganized, and sort of not ready to fill the vacuum if Islamic State is pushed out.
I wanted to mention one other aspect, and that was there was an attempted abduction by Turkish gang members of a Syrian rebel commander inside Turkey. And apparently these Turkish gang members had been paid money by the Islamic State. And there are reports that IS has a very potent network inside Turkey, and this has raised concerns about American forces in Turkey. There are U.S. airmen and their families at Incirlik Air Base. Mm. There are also Air Force personnel in Ankara and Izmir and Gaziantep. How reliable, Tim, is Turkey as an ally in this fight? And how, you know, is the fact that that IS appears to have a network inside Turkey one of the reasons that Turkey has been hesitant about allowing reinforcements in Kobani?
Well, I think that they have to be counted on to seek their own interest, Turkey, that is. And so when we talk about the reliability of them as an ally, they have their own interest here at stake. And they have, you know, IS right on their doorstep. The United States has been pummeling IS positions with increasing frequency, and but I'm not sure that there should be a huge worry right now that airmen or mm-hmm. soldiers are kidnapped in Turkey. I mean, it's not something that I've heard a lot of.
This was a report from a military website that I saw this week. It was mm-hmm. the first time I'd seen it, which was why it kind of caught my eye when we realized, you know, the ransoms that, that are being collected for people. This was a concern. But hold the thought. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of All Monitor. Joining me today are Tim Mak of The Daily Beast and Stephen Collinson of CNN Politics. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Last thought on Turkey, and then we'll move to Asia.
Yeah, I think that as a NATO ally, you got to work closely with them. And I'm not sure there's a lot of indication right now that anything other than normal security procedures needs to be implemented.
All right, well, watch that space. We're going to turn now to North Korea. And Stephen, we were talking about this a little bit before the show. It's 20 years since the agreed framework was signed with North Korea. This was a deal to keep North Korea from developing nuclear weapons. And although it collapsed under the George W. Bush administration, it did succeed for a while. What is the state of play now between the U.S. and North Korea? And do you think there are any indications that we could finally start talking to them again after they let go this American this week?
Yeah, I mean, as always, North Korea, it's absolutely impossible to penetrate the thinking of the leaders of North Korea. I mean, that's one of the constants, perhaps one of the only constants, is that 20 years ago, U.S. officials, at that time, the Clinton administration was trying to read the tea leaves of North Korea's behavior. They eventually, against their better judgment, agreed to send Jimmy Carter to Pyongyang to help negotiate this deal. A couple of things that, you know, in retrospect, people have criticized this deal, saying in many ways it sort of amounted to appeasement of North Korea, and North Korea then cheated on the deal. But if we remember back in 1994, there was a time of extreme tension. There were serious people in the U.S. government who believed that there may be a war between the West and North Korea. And if you ever go to Korea, you know that the DMZ is just 20 miles or so from downtown Seoul, where there are thousands of rockets targeting from the north. So it would have been a disaster if there was a war on the Korean Peninsula. So just from the fact that that was averted, you could say that the agreement was a success up to a point. But, you know, the thing that I... back in 1994, a lot of people in the sort of policy community sort of didn't expect the North Korean regime to outlive Kim Il-sung, expect it would endure this long. And here we are again. We've got an unpredictable, inscrutable North Korean leader. I mean, we don't even know if he's well. He fell out of the public view for an extended period of time. A lot of speculation whether there had been a coup in North Korea. Then this U.S. hostage was released this week. So, you know, trying to work out exactly what the North Koreans' strategy is and their intentions is, it's very difficult. And now, you know, this is a country that I think the estimate is they have about 10 nuclear bombs or the material for that number of bombs. There's concerns about proliferation, the missile program. So, you know, 20 years on, it's still a very, very dangerous situation. The six-party talks process is basically ground to a halt. And there's still the issue of this unpredictable, dangerous, isolated, paranoid regime being armed with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I wanted to read something that Bob Gallucci, who was the chief U.S. negotiator for the agreed framework, said recently. He said that from a pure nonproliferation standpoint, the agreed framework was, quote, a success for its time, unquote, and that without it, the North Koreans would have had by now an arsenal of nuclear weapons instead of however many, 10, or the material for 10 or so nuclear weapons. Tim, you know, should the United States be re-engaging with North Korea? We're insisting that we say we will talk to them, but only if they agree that the main topic of discussion will be their denuclearization.
Yeah, I mean, now that they have a stockpile of nuclear weapons, it's hard to imagine them ever relinquishing them or being honest about relinquishing them. It's clear that there's some willingness now on behalf of the regime for some openness. They sent leaders to South Korea suddenly this month.
And to the European Union, and their UN ambassador went to the Council on Foreign Relations to give a talk, which is not a usual thing.
Yeah, and they've also made the surprising move to release an American. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be openness, but like Stephen was saying, this is a tremendously opaque regime. We have no idea what kinds of moves they're going to be making. And it's hard for me to imagine what the benefit to talks on nuclear weapons would be if what we're dealing with is an untrustworthy actor that really can't be held to its word.
Well, you know, North Koreans did obey some aspects of the agreed framework, and the U.S. followed through with some aspects, but not all. And I wrote a piece actually for VOA recently about what lessons we could learn from this for the Iran experience, which is that both sides have to comply. It's not enough just for one. Under the agreed framework, the North Koreans promised not to develop nuclear weapons, and in return, the U.S. Sent the North Koreans heavy fuel oil, which they needed. And Congress was often late in appropriating the funds to send the heavy fuel oil, and people suffered in North Korea as a result. U.S. was also supposed to supervise construction of light water nuclear reactors for peaceful purposes, and it dragged its feet very much on that as well. So one lesson, I think, is that if you're going to sign a nuclear agreement with a country, especially a country like North Korea, you have to be scrupulous in implementing it on your side if you expect them to be as well. But I want to turn to an area that I know you're very familiar with, Tim, and that's Hong Kong. If you could bring us up to date on what's been going on there, the protests there, and whether this this enclave of capitalism is actually going to get more political freedom as well.
You know, it's super interesting. Hong Kong protests have moved into its fifth week, and you can feel on the street that the energy is kind of ebbing. That the enthusiasm that you saw in the first and second week is yielding now to a lot of pessimism. One of the great successes of this protest movement has been to grab the Chinese government and the Hong Kong government by the collar and drag them into the debate.
Yes, a literal debate.
Into a literal a televised debate between the student protesters and the Hong Kong government, and to give a very, very public platform that people will notice, to make the argument for why Hong Kongers should be able to elect candidates of their own choosing. The real issue right now has been that that the Hong Kong government has proposed democratic elections which would only involve candidates approved by Beijing or that were favorable to Beijing, which student protesters don't view as something that is appropriate, that is not sufficient for a real democracy. They want to be able to lower the bar for candidates so that anyone with any views should be able to run the government of Hong Kong. That doesn't look like that's going to happen, and it does look like, in the end, the Hong Kong government and Beijing is going to get its way.
There was some talk, though, wasn't there, Tim, that they might broaden the choices for the elections at least somewhat?
Really, the biggest concession that
for future elections, perhaps not this one.
Yes, I mean the biggest concession that the Hong Kong government has been willing to give right now is that they will write a report. They will change their report.
They will change their report.
They will change their report to Beijing to note how unhappy people are in Hong Kong.
That's
really the major concession.
Yeah. Stephen, you've also spent some time in Hong Kong. I have to say, though, listening to this account makes me think of, again, of Iran, of the Guardian Council. When the Iranians vote, they can only vote for candidates who've been vetted by something called the Guardian Council, so that anybody who has any kind of real dissenting views about the system are sort of immediately eliminated before the fact. Do you see any changes coming from this? Do you see any ripple effects on China itself?
I think what's interesting is that the Chinese government, which is ultimately in control of this situation, has shown some political dexterity in not, sending PLA troops in to break up the protests or, trying to force the hand of the Hong Kong government. It seems that they realize that the best way to firewall this may not be to have sort of pictures of a demonstration being smashed that
Tiananmen,
could,
yeah.
Be transmitted through China on social media, etc. And there's also the fact that China's going to host the APEC summit next month, I believe, in Beijing. I don't think that they want any occurrences that would be problematic for Western leaders to have to come to Beijing and face questions about what China's doing in Hong Kong.
That's the Asia-Pacific
Economic Cooperation Summit.
Summit, okay.
And President Obama is also, I believe, I don't think it's been announced yet, but there's an informal meeting with Xi Jinping along the lines of the summit they held in California.
Sure.
So I think we might see the current situation prevail for at least the next month or so. I saw an interesting poll, though, that said that core support in Hong Kong for the protesters has actually gone up in the last month to about 38%. So it seems that there's a well of support for the demonstrations in Hong Kong, although if that is sustained and produces the kind of mass demonstrations we saw a few weeks ago, I guess is doubtful.
Yeah. Tim, do you think, I would think that just the fact of these protests and also the fact that this affects the younger generation, after all, these are people who were very small children when Hong Kong reverted from the British to mainland control back in 1997. Obviously, I think the Chinese government, the Beijing government, has to be somewhat alert to the fact that there is this new generation coming up in Hong Kong and they have some different views. They're not as obedient as their parents were.
Undoubtedly. And they're connected to the world in a way that a lot of mainland, younger mainland people are not. They're listening to music that you can't listen to in Beijing. It's not censored by Beijing.
Oh, is the internet freer then in Hong Kong?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, at least through legitimate means. Mm. I mean, in Hong Kong, you can read CNN.com, you can go to VOA, but you cannot do that in Beijing or Shanghai or anywhere else without bypassing the regular methods of using the internet. And there's also really not just that connection gap, but also there's a language gap between mainland China and Hong Kong. And so while this is, you know, quite a dangerous threat to the Chinese government, I think they feel quite secure in the sense that there aren't tremendous amounts of links between Cantonese-speaking Hong Kong and the many other dialects that are spoken in mainland China.
Okay. Well, it's interesting to talk about this for a change. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mak, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.